Case 98-824, Cincinnati Bar Association versus W. Day Purchey Jr.
Chief Justice, your rights. There's court.
Usually you wait till you're called on, so that's why I'm saying your name. That's all right, you may begin.
Apologize.
Sorry.
Matter of behalf of respondent, Mr. Purchey, he's seated here before you, apparently 51 years of age, married to St. Lady, 30 years, Senate practice, Charles, St. 72, mainly as a sole practitioner. There's no prior problem with his court, if anyone has that matter, until these issues arose a couple years ago. And what this case represents, in my judgment, is Mr. Purchey ran into a chapter 13. Trustee who essentially ran by persons with lawyer, never been by the time, never filed a chapter 7, never filed a chapter 13. Only prior experience with matters involved is his court for Judge Hogg. This matter basically started when a gentleman by the name of Valerie called the chapter 13 trustee's office, not the purpose of complaining in any way about this Purchey, but just inquiring when he could expect to receive a chapter 13 discharge since he can shave off his chapter 13 claim. This Burks, the chapter 13 trustee, then asking when he did that. He then began checking the records and established that that was in fact the case. And she asked how he did that, but he had refinancing from Associates Finance. She then looked at other records as to Mr. Purchey's name and found that there was five other people that had essentially paid off their chapter 13 clients, obtained financing with from Associates. And from these loans, Mr. Purchey was in fact paid a fee. This Burks, without the permission of either Purchey or his clients, obtained Associates confidential records of the sale of the loan. She then, without consulting with Mr. Purchey and Burke at all, filed a motion with the bankruptcy court requesting that these fees be set aside. Originally, she said that Mr. Purchey should sanction because he had not obtained court approval to incur new indebtedness, and that he had not obtained court approval as these attorneys. But as the new indebtedness, the evidence shows that Mr. Purchey had, in fact, as of that time, filed his applications, and they had all been approved. The evidence also shows that those applications basically are for the purpose of what a person intends to stay in a chapter 13 plan, and at some point, you know, these people are often in there 2 or 3 years, they needed a car. So the court looks at it and says, well, maybe you shouldn't really buy a Mercedes, maybe you should just give them a Hyundai, one of those cars. In other words, it's meant to protect the integrity of the plan so that the person doesn't get more debt than they can comply with the plan. It's not meant for the purpose where a person seeks to refinance to get out of the chapter 13. It's not, the person is not incurring new indebtedness. You simply can get a loan to pay off the old debts. The evidence is clear that people do this for a number of reasons. Some of them just feel it impacts their credit rating and limits them what they can do. They don't like having their employer take money out of their check and send it to 13. The evidence is clear that none of these people complain about these fees to this firm. They haven't to date. They were all happy to get out of chapter 13 plan. The only two people that this firm's actually talked to were Mr. Mallory and Mr. Springer. Only Mr. Springer testified at the hearing before the panel. And I think you can read this testimony. Mr. Purchey helping the title of lunch chapter 13. But at least two and probably three where Mr. Springer was unable to complete the plan, got kicked out. Mr. Purchey filed another one for him without ever getting paid fully for the first one. Some of the substance is testimony. Mr. Purchey helped him, and had I asked him, he would have said he loves David Purchey. sanctions, and she also contemporaneously sent a copy of it to the Bar Association. They began investigation before there was any ever disposition by the bankruptcy court. The next matter was Mr. Reddick, elderly gentleman. Mr. Birch couldn't be at his hearing, but had another lawyer to see off and say. Mr. Reddick made a simple statement that he thought the gentleman by the name of Wayne West was a lawyer. And then, based upon that, Burks sent another complaint to the Bar Association. Nobody after that ever talked to Mr. Reddick or inquired what caused him to believe that. There's no evidence that Mr. West ever represented himself to anyone as an attorney. There's no evidence that Mr. West ever engaged in the practice of law. Contacted Mr. Burchie with a complaint that he was suborning the unauthorized practice of law by Wayne West. By the time I got into it, Mr. Burchie, as he indicated, was devastated. He's getting right and left. He's having trouble dealing with it. So he called on me because we share office space with some other people. So when I got into it, it issued speedy for his escrow account, his operating account, and his personal account with his wife. I said, what does this have to do with your first time? As long as you have any evidence that Mr. Wayne West ever appeared in court, or did he ever did any of the tradition? No, we don't. So by that time, in an effort to cooperate, that I got in earlier, I would have motion for a protective order. But it was a little too late for that, so we went, and then we went through all those checks. And questioned him, and when one of his file another motion to vacate the attorney's fees. Send Mr. Brady a letter. Send a copy to Judge Ott. Send a copy to the Bar Association. Saying you don't have to pay these. There's been no error. You don't have to pay these attorney's fees. And instead, you get other counsel, and they'll give you 3 days. Clearly, improper ethical violations on her part. Ex parte communications to court, talking to Mr. Burgess' client, telling him that he doesn't have to pay. Submit once again to demonstrate what occurred here. Mayor, at this point, I'd like to deserve whatever comments.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Boyd. Mr. Rice.
Chief Justice, Justice of the Court, good morning. My name is James Rice, I'm from the St. Bar Association. We wanted to address the relating order's objections to the board's decision, which Mr. Kroll will address the relating order's answer to respondents' objections. The relating order's objections are confined to Canon 3 issues only. There are two. One was there some sort of partnership between Mr. Burgess and Mr. West in violation of DR 3103A? And was the form provided by Mr. Burgess in which Mr. West could operate the aiding of an unlawyer in the unauthorized practice of law in violation of DR 3101A? DR 3103A prohibits an attorney from forming a partnership with an unlawyer in any activity if the activity of a partnership practice of law. The investigation did not disclose a formal written agreement or was wanted and expected. The evidence, however, was clear from an examination of financial transactions between the parties and the testimony of the two parties, Mr. West and Mr. Burgess, that Mr. West was at financial risk as to the profitability of the Suburban office for his compensation and for reimbursement of his expenses. In fact, Mr. West was paid very little because the office was not there for profit, which indicates a co-owner attribute to his participation. This was a set of circumstances that Mr. West and Mr. Burgess had participated in for some period of time. In order to examine what exactly went on between them, we examined where the money flowed. And as such, we are at a brief, made the allegation, and provided clear and convincing evidence that Mr. West was an at-risk position, in which at-risk position for his financial compensation for his time is the attribute of an entrepreneur, not the attribute of an employee. It was clearly established in the facts that Mr. West was not paid a salary. He took money at his own discretion, using his own signature authority over the Suburban accounts, and paid himself and paid his own expenses. That is expenses for a child support in one case, and then expenses for reimbursement of ordinary but necessary business.
Is there any ethical rule or any case law that says that paralegals have to be employed on a salary basis only, or that you can't pay paralegals that you make money? I'm in good trouble following this jump you make from the fact that he got paid and the office made money to there's a partnership versus, you know, he was an employee and the boss made money, he got money and the boss didn't make money, he didn't make money.
The parties in their testimony, in their record, clearly indicated there was no salary paid, although there was money intended, they just never did. And it was very clear to me in the process of the investigation and in the hearing that the panel understood quite clearly that Mr. West in his own show as to the Suburban office, very minimal supervision by Mr.
Is that more indicative of a sloppy boss or a hairless boss versus practicing law? What evidence did you have that Mr. West himself was practicing law? That's the issue, not how the business branches were.
I'm going to address that in the second part of my comment.
Why don't you go to that?
All right, I'll be glad.
That's more persuasive to me.
Okay. The panel found that in examining the issue of 101A about a lawyer aiding a non-lawyer in unauthorized practice of law, that Mr. Burgess rented a Suburban office, outfitted it with appropriate office equipment, telecommunications facilities, etc.
do that, don't they?
Yes, secure information from the clients.
Apparently, who's do that, don't they?
Discuss, yes, ma'am, yeah, discuss and set fees and collected fees, prepare documents, obtain client...
Setting fees and collecting fees, the practice of law?
I believe it is.
Okay.
Preparing documents, obtaining client signatures on documents.
Were those documents reviewed by Mr. Birch?
Yes.
So, if documents were reviewed by Mr. Birch, is it still in parallel role?
Yes, ma'am, that's correct. He also was responsible for the financial accounting of the office, which is a TIT, which is a permissible parallel activity. But it's also discussed and found that he provided testimony, by his own testimony, plus testimony of witnesses that he discussed with clients, out of presence of Mr. Birch, that the differences in peculiarities of Chapter 7 bankruptcy, Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and one case involving Mr. Campbell, a combination item that he called his own colloquialism, a Chapter 20 bankruptcy, that is, he filed a Chapter 7 bankruptcy for certain kinds of debts, and then filed a Chapter 13 bankruptcy after the 7th was discharged for a different set of debts. In this case, to me, that is the practice of law by anybody's definition. The activities of Mr. West are clearly, especially the advising clients about particular peculiarities of the law between Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcy issues, certainly is a common sense definition of practice of law. But be that as may, this court in 1934 in Land Abstract Title v. DeWorken cited, which cites in our brief, that the court has, and the court has stated in the Newmont case, it's not necessary to find a judicial decision that a non-lawyer is engaged in unauthorized practice of law to find that an attorney is assisting a non-lawyer in unauthorized practice of law. What Mr. West did in this case, he provided his name as the title to the office, from which Mr. West did conduct business. The business Mr. West conducted, by the evidence found, clear to me and to many others who look at it, is the practice of law, especially advising clients between one type of bankruptcy procedure and another type of bankruptcy procedure, and making decisions on completion of documents. Even though Mr. Birch did sign the documents before filing in court.
Do you have any clear case law as to how far along that continuing paralegal for law to go?
I'm sorry, I'm probably a question.
If a paralegal is not allowed to give clients options, we can advise them options, that is strictly beyond paralegal.
And that's what we're asking this court to decide.
Respondent's objections to the panel's recommendations on really two points. First, the evidence is clear and convincing that the panel's recommended violations should be found, should be adopted by this court. And second, the proposed penalty of an indefinite suspension is warranted by the nature and the severity of those violations. Respondent admits that he failed to comply with the bankruptcy court's orders. On at least two occasions, the bankruptcy court ordered him to file detailed fee applications involving the fees for what I'll call the mortgage loan refinancing transactions. Mr. Burchy didn't do it. He didn't appeal it, he didn't request reconsideration, he didn't file anything with the bankruptcy court saying, I don't think I should have to do this, and here's why. He simply didn't comply. Similarly, with respect to the Burnett transaction, where the bankruptcy court ordered him to refund the $650 that Burnett had already paid as a sanction, again, Mr. Burchy didn't agree with that ruling, but he didn't challenge it in any proper way. He simply didn't comply. And at the time of the hearing, he had not complied. He admitted at the hearing, by endorsing Mr. West's testimony, that he did not properly maintain trust funds for his Norwood office. Mr. West testified that client funds were routinely put into what he called a regular account, and that disbursements for non-expense items were routinely made from what he called the trust accounts, and Mr. Burchy said he agreed with Mr. West's testimony. Clear violation of DR 9102. The evidence is clear and convincing that respondent violated DR 1102A 4 and 5 when he submitted to the bankruptcy court a false statement that he had received no attorney's fees from the Burnings. And he advised the Burnings, don't tell the bankruptcy court about those previous fees that you paid. The bankruptcy court found that that was a false statement. Mr. Burchy claimed it was an oversight, but the bankruptcy court found it was a false statement. Excuse me, and the panel found that it was a false statement. That submission of false statement to the bankruptcy court violated DR 1102, and I think that's compounded by Mr. Burchy telling his client, don't tell the court you paid me the previous $650.
I'm not going to bankruptcy, so I need a little bit of clear.
I'm not a bankruptcy practitioner either, Your Honor.
The loan track transaction where he got the loan for the client that paid off the Chapter 13, was that in and of itself, ignoring that whether he should have filed this product, was that transaction in itself an illegal or wrong transaction? I'm not
really sure. We believe it was a wrong transaction in the sense that it put Mr. Burchy in a position of conflict with his client in the following ways. Number one, his client didn't know Mr. Burchy was getting a fee paid through the loan funds. And in two of the transactions, the loan funds were used to pay a fee to this fictitious entity, CSI. Mr. West and Mr. Burchy admit that ultimately those fees were paid to Mr. Burchy. That in and of itself is a violation of the DR that says an attorney shall not accept the fee from a third party. Why it went through this CSI fictitious character is unknown, but it violates the DR. We believe it's a conflict of interest with the attorney's own interests in putting Mr. Burchy in a position where his financial interest in getting these fees of $1,200 to $1,900 per transaction in conflict with his client's interest, as the bankruptcy court found. They were changing low-rate unsecured debt to high-rate secured debt. To the tune of at least one client testified, they refinanced a 9% mortgage to a 20% mortgage. And the only person who benefited from that was Mr. Burchy. He got the fees. And the client didn't know about the fees before the loan transactions occurred. The final example, Your Honor, is the one that you raised. In those loan transactions, the fees were not disclosed to the client. In at least two of the six transactions, those fees were put through, admittedly, a third party, but were ultimately received by Mr. Burchy. And that violates DR 5107 and 5101. Let me address the penalty very briefly. We believe that the nature and the pattern of this misconduct justifies what we recognize as a severe penalty of indefinite suspension. The panel went through these many counts, and we recognize this is a more complicated than usual case, and the panel in its decision went to great lengths to say how complicated and unusual this case was. And they sorted through it very carefully. They didn't find in the Bar Association paper on all counts. They dismissed a couple of counts, as Mr. Wright pointed out, that we think should have been sustained. But they carefully went through the evidence and ultimately concluded that this conduct was serious and the pattern was such that an indefinite suspension is warranted. We believe this court's past pronouncements on appropriate penalties in lawyer discipline cases fully support a suspension in this case. We think an indefinite suspension is warranted, and that's what we request this court to do. But certainly, an actual suspension is warranted by the severity and the pattern. And real people were really hurt by this misconduct. This is not some technical conflict of interest that nothing really happened, but there was a technical violation of the rules. People were hurt by this conduct. The Campbells lost their house. Ms. Cooper's had her utility shut off for a couple months and had to move her children to a shelter because of Mr. Virtue's inattention to a matter and lack of supervision of Mr. Wentz. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Crowell. Mr. Boyd, you've saved about 3.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you. Now, with respect to Ms. Cooper, Ms. Cooper's testimony is, first you stated that she came to see Mr. Virtue in August, and it turned out later that wasn't correct. She came in the middle of September. Mr. West immediately sent a letter to CG&E advising that they're going to file a bankruptcy petition. And within 5 days, the bankruptcy petition was prepared. Ms. Cooper did not get back in time. Through her own fault, she eventually got in and sometime in early October, and her utilities were shut off for 4 or 5 days at the most. So the bankruptcy petition was filed. Mr. West had to cause the back to be sent to CG&E. Ms. Cooper sent Ms. Murphy a letter. Ms. Murphy and her birthday got to a 10 or 341B. She never attempted to call on the trustee, gave the opportunity, said, well, if you want to continue to apply, we'll go. If this happens to any attorney, I hope it doesn't happen. The lines have to be 30-some years. After he wants in the Sixth Circuit of the United States, marked down for a month later. But she got, the trustee went ahead, she got her discharge. She'd already agreed to surrender her car. Her car was long gone. She was in her house. She wasn't in any way harmed. Plus the court office. And the Campbells, Mr. Campbell clearly indicated that he went out on his own to try to resolve his mortgage with his mortgage holders. Felt that they were uptight. Apparently, he felt like he was dealing with a mortgage holder didn't tell attorneys because they proceeded to get with the foreclosure. Of course, he had Chapter 13 prepared, told him to come in and make an appointment to come in. They never came in until 2 months after their house was foreclosed upon. By which they asked the girls apparently to come in for additional services, helping with their Social Security, helping with a couple other things. And lastly, on we were raised on behalf of the Virtue due process argument with regard to the conduct of this hearing. I think we were entitled to have a full panel at the very least. I think we were entitled to have two people on there that were lawyers. I think the panel chairman demonstrated, I think, throughout, obviously, as prejudice to Mr. Virtue. And I'm well aware that he's president of the Constitutional Bar Association. I wasn't. I was the president-elect. But if you just read the record, he made Judge Hall kind of an expert witness on the DRs over my objection. Inexplicably, because either the realtor or we had asked him these questions, clearly indicated that various times that he had already read the record from the desk, looked at all these exhibits, not of which had been admitted in the cabinet. We said that, at the very least, Mr. Virtue is entitled to a new hearing on this. And I think the sanctions recommended, given his man's impeccable record, given the nature of the transactions, none of which, in my judgment, established a violation of the DRs. I think at most, the public recommend would be warranted.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.